Greetings, everyone. My name is Kaz.
This is Medibot.
And this is the Skulls Cast episode. Let me quickly look up the episode number. 55. How about that?
That's also my IQ.
Where Medibot and myself do a all Skulls Cast episode. We have no explicit topic. Rather,
An all Skulls asked Skulls Cast.
Yes. It is a Skulls Ask Skulls Cast.
That's very difficult for me to say.
I believe it would be difficult for any native English speaker to say Skulls Ask Skulls Cast. That was partially my point in creating the Skulls Asked.
It honestly hurts my tongue a little bit to think about.
Acha! You gotta have a whip tongue, boy! Yeah, you know, I'm not even that great at it either, and I've had lots of practice, so let's hope we get better at it as time goes on. I'm going to crack open our skulls with the first Skulls Asked question, if you don't mind.
Go hog wild.
Okay, our first question comes from Teal Hydra, who asks, do you think an interesting RPG or RPG-like game could be made using no numbers greater than 32?
No number is greater than 32?
That is the question as Teal Hydra asked it of us.
Easily.
Yes.
I can modify Paper Mario slightly to fulfill your parameters.
I can, I think, just take River City Ransom as it stands and use it. And even, well, okay, so that's perhaps not RPG-like. It is a beat-em-up, and it has numbers largely by accident, honestly. It's almost like the game didn't want to have numbers at all. But then they're like, man, how are we really going to track our progress if we don't, like... Let's just tell the user that these numbers are there and let them see their numbers so that they can know... So they can form value judgments and all that. Mm. And I honestly... We've been at this for a while... And we took a lot of long breaks because we've been doing other things.
Yes, the things.
Myself, I mean, you, come on, everybody who listens to this also watches, like, all of the other stuff that I do. So you basically know what I've been up to. Most of it has been streaming. Some of it has been catching a cold and walking over. I did, because I am a curmudgeon... And I don't like people. I've already accomplished all of my Christmas shopping in the space of an afternoon, in which I spent most of that afternoon simply walking from place to place. Very little total shopping done, but here I am and I'm finished. So that's also a thing. But with it out of the way, we're back to the Skulls Cast and Skulls Asked. But I do confess that I had read this question a while ago and already had a little bit of a discussion with Medibot about it.
Yes.
Where I bit us down to 6.
Yeah. And we managed a 6.
And I'm pretty sure that we could make an interesting RPG or RPG-like game with no numbers greater than 6, including things like total actors on the screen at any given time, characters allowed in names of things, total number of words in the sentences spoken, that kind of thing. Like
number of letters in the words in those sentences?
I'm pretty sure that we could bid it all down to 6 and still make a coherent and interesting game. I mean, honestly...
Possibly even fun.
Well, yeah, that would be an ideal thing, but before it becomes fun, I think it would be interesting as an exercise, as just... Wow, they really did never use thing like numbers larger than 6, like anywhere, and you know then you could appreciate it as a kind of performance piece in itself, a kind of like game created for the sake of the art of the craft rather than the sake of making a game that's fun or interesting, which most of the time I object to, but in this case. It would be me doing it, so I think that would be okay.
It would be very experimental, and I like experimental things. I like doing experiments, Kaz.
Yeah, and then we can title it something like Hex of the Skullmaster or something, And
yeah, Hex of the Skull Master. That's five words, none of which are longer than six letters.
Wait, oh, shit. Wait, Skull is a character, not a letter, not a, like, the word Skull, but just, like, Master.
Yeah.
And then, oh, Skull Master is two different words.
Yeah.
Oh, then it works perfectly.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm already off to a great start. So I'm pretty sure that, no matter what, our answer to that question is a resounding yes.
Yes.
You can absolutely make an RPG or RPG-like game with numbers no greater than 32.
Yes. And we'll have to get started on a Hex of the Skull Master at some point. Maybe after I finished Jazz Ball for Fuckers.
I have a lot of ideas about what that can be, by the way.
Have you seen my screenshots?
I have, and I thought you were being, like, not aggressive enough with how you were beta testing your game. You need to get sharper angles in there. Really push the limits of your line drawing procedure.
Okay. So to answer your question, Teal Hydra, we can and eventually we will.
Yes. Okay, so Manybot, do you have a hopper of
I'm empty.
I could have sworn that you had some, like from, like in your tank.
No, I looked back, and the last question I saw was the Kirby question.
Oh no, we totally did the Kirby question. All right, well, I guess I'll just pick another one at random here, being a little unfair to people who, you know, asked in order and everything, but I feel like doing this one instead.
Sufficiently chaotic system is maximally fair.
Oh, I'm not being fair, matey. Anyway, listener Coke with Limey asks, what do you chaps make of the Wii U? The gamepad gives opportunities for players, player apostrophe S, to have lots of hidden information in local multiplayer games, which Mediboot, said in context, mentioned liking as a concept in a previous cast. I kind of remember that cast.
Man, do I love hidden information.
I know that you claim to love. Yeah, you definitely claim to love symmetric information. Maybe I'm gonna look us up really quick. I'll let you drone on about what your thoughts about the.
Okay, so
the
here's
Wii U
the.
Are.
So we got a Wii U, and no one really cares about it because what can you play on it? You've got Nintendo Land, and you know that's all right. And you've got Mario Brothers, and that's all right. But two instances of that's all right isn't going to make me go out and spend $400 American on a new video game machine, especially when I've got this perfectly good, you know, pile of other games for older systems that I'm still working through.
Now, does the Wii U still play Wii games?
It does still play Wii games. It does not play GameCube games.
Yeah, well.
It also has lots of nice online feature stuff, and I've heard that Zombie U is actually a pretty cool game, and maybe I want to check that out. And I guess as far as, like, I mean, yes, this is a new angle that we can design for, you know, given this hardware,
we can come up
with new ideas.
The design itself is, I think, the heart of the question here. And I did look it up in episode 38 of the Skulls cast. You spent a lot of time, and we spent a lot of time talking about hidden information in games.
Talking
so clearly,
about
it's
Stratego.
Yeah, clearly, yeah. It's something that we like. I guess that was the ultimate like answer there. I play a game that has tons of hidden information, and I like it, and I'm planning on like taking down an entire large tournament this weekend if I can find a way to get to Baltimore. I might have to start walking now.
Baltimore.
But I'll get there and I'll take it down, and it has lots of hidden information. So I'm not opposed to hidden information in any like concept sense, and I think it is an angle that the Wii U has that other game systems basically have not had. They've clearly built up to it. Like, everything that Nintendo ever does has already happened, basically. They go through a really really, really long and complex beta and alpha testing program that is like all of the design of everything that they do. If you go and look at your Nintendo DS Lite from back when, like, that was the thing. You know, the 3DS comes from the DS Lite, right? You know, DS Lite comes from the DS.
Well, there's also the DSi and the DSi XL.
Yeah. And they've done through revisions of that. But the DS itself is not actually new hat, because if you look at some of the original, like, Game and Watch
machine
things, you can see that they always wanted to do that. That there's... That design had already existed, basically. So, somewhere along the line, I don't even know where the first, like, Nintendo idea could even come from, in that sense. But it's all been building up to this. So, you know, with the Wii U, my example here of, you know, they've done this before, is with the GameCube and the Game Boy Advance, like, Link cable doodad that
you
we
have,
just spent a long time using.
At once. One containing supplemental information sometimes. Although the gamepad can also be used as just the proper screen, if you want to.
Right. And crucially, this is information delivered only to one person.
Right.
In a system that is itself inherently built to, like, service and supply to, like...
Right. I think that a given Wii U only supports one of the gamepads at a time, or maybe two.
I thought
not
it was
four,
two.
Definitely.
I'm pretty sure it's two.
I can believe two.
Like, you have the two,
the
and
other
then
thing
other
that,
stuff is going
that
on,
that I just
like,
thought of,
screen.
If I want to be really reductionist and cynical, is that we took a DS and split it in half and put the top screen and called it your television, and the bottom screen is the gamepad.
And yet
there are
I don't
a lot
think
of games
there's...
on the DS that are like supplemental information on
sure.
bottom screen, action on top screen because it does good graphics on the top screen.
And yet I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
There's nothing
so
wrong
I,
with that.
Like, short of
like...
being cynical, I would say that's just plain descriptive, just innovative. Like, yeah, okay, well...
It's cynical in the sense that they're not giving us anything new. They're just giving us a bigger 3DS that plays Wii games.
That you don't have to, like, sit in well-lighted areas to understand or squint all the time to see.
Yeah, also that.
What is people's fascination with tiny screens nowadays? If
because
I could
you can
be
carry them with you.
Fuck
it's
that.
It's portable. It goes wherever you go.
You know what?
You know what else goes
no,
wherever I go? A lot
my
of things
skull,
I'd rather not
my
carry
bones.
With me.
My bones go where I go. Okay, so the... Oh, wait, the original question was, what do we make of the Wii U?
Well, I make of it.
I don't know.
I mean,
I like it.
Seems all right.
I like
there,
it
there is
on
a game coming
on
for it that I am
level.
Genuinely hyped for.
And it opens the door for a lot of shit that could have existed up to now in the DS, but didn't. Do you remember when you and I tried to play Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles Ring of Fates?
Yeah. Well, I'd give it more than
I
tried to. We did.
Well, I mean, I enjoyed it because I had already played through the game and I really enjoyed the game. And I don't know how much you enjoyed it.
It was pretty decent.
We were... It was kind of frenetic.
Did bird magic.
Yeah. Oh, and like... stood on a pedestal so that it would zoom in on your character. You could see your clothes and stuff. Oh, yeah, that was a fun little thing. But just think about it. Instead of, you know, take that same experience, and instead of both of us in the same room, like, looking at these tiny screens, we would be sitting on the couch looking at the same big screen for, like, the shared experience, and then we would be able to look at the little screen, which is slightly bigger itself, for the, like, inventory and... mucking about in the menu that you know, information
that
you don't need to share.
The important in-betweening of doing bird magic.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be fine. Again, you know,
so
being
like,
limited
I see
to
it,
two
I guess...
gamepads limits us to this being a two-player experience and not a four-player experience unless we're doing online multiplayer, which I think is totally fine and maybe should be an avenue that gets explored further, because if I could play... like, four-player online Ring of Fates, I would kind of be all over that.
Well, I have a hard enough time getting you to play, like, online Diablo 3, which...
That's because I die a bunch.
That's because you need to sell all of your things and buy better
ones. I do need to stop hoarding my worthless items that have silly names and buy something that makes me, like, a better kill wizard already.
Oh, but wait, no. I found a staff that was named Black Magic Crux. And I thought that earned a spot.
That's like
next to the device.
Yeah, it's weirdly self-deprecating. It's like, yeah, I can do really good magic as long as I got this thing.
Black Magic Crux.
So, what I make of the Wii U is that there's a, like, you know, I'm optimistic. I think that something really interesting is going to get made for the Wii U, and once that happens, I'll buy one.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, I'm hyped basically. For the new Rayman, because the last Rayman was, like, pretty much amazing. And then they're making a Pikmin game. That could be hype. I liked Pikmin 2 a whole damn lot.
I think if you play Pikmin a little, I'm just gonna go and play Brood War again and again until you're done with Pikmin, and then we can review the same game or something.
Yeah, well, it's like, Pikmin is a game... Pikmin is a survival horror game.
Wait, no, I've got it.
It's the secret.
What we'll do... No. What we'll do is you will play Pikmin, and I will play StarCraft. And then we'll review both games, except when you're talking about Pikmin, you'll use all the names and stuff from StarCraft, and when I'm talking about StarCraft, I'll use all the, like, names from Pikmin. So instead of...
Show how well they map.
Instead of Jim Raynor, I'll say Captain Olimar. Yeah. And instead of... Terran Marine, I will say Yellow Pikmin.
Yellow.
Or something.
Red.
Red.
Blue. And then they got, like, Rock Pikmin coming in the next one? Or something wild like that. I don't know why they got rid of Pooples and replaced them with rocks.
I don't know anything about Pikmin. And I only kind of know stuff about StarCraft. That's the embarrassing part, is that there's so many people that I see on their like Blizzard forums who are like, yo, what up, StarCraft lore, bam, and there's like three novels set in the StarCraft universe that I hadn't read because they're like rephrasings of all of the stuff I learned from Brood War by
playing
it.
Here's what I want to know about the StarCraft universe.
Except there's this...
Do they have fruit by the foot there?
Page-long description of Kerrigan's emotions while the Zerg is taking over her body and just, like, changing it and, like, horror stuff. I don't know. I kind of stayed away from those. Maybe not enough.
So they
so
don't
that's
have
what we
food
make
by
of,
the foot?
That's what we make of the Wii U.
Yeah. That's what we make of the Wii U.
So thanks for your question, and we will eventually get to all of these, so keep the Skulls Asked Hopper going. We're going to...
Tossing them in.
Continue this episode. I was going to say conclude, but really this topic is going to take up the majority of our time. Every now and again, the Skulls Asked questions that we collect are too large for little
too
answers.
Huge.
I mean, really, the Skulls Asked answers that we give are themselves a little long. And
I love hearing my voice.
And, you know, we just can't stop talking about things when we start up to a point. And I think that's a little bit of what makes the Skulls Cast what it is.
Yes.
But nonetheless, I've identified these two so far, two topics. We're only covering one of them tonight because it's, again, these are large things. I identified them as, like, no, wait, I want to devote an entire episode to this. I want this to be a large topic. And our first one comes from Gnomebitten, who asked, you and Medibot have mentioned more than a few times some cards you've made. What goes into making your own sets?
Well, so I haven't really made them. Here's what I make. I make blue enchantments that don't do anything. this is the only kind of card that the design part of my brain understands. So it's
Oh, come on. Hell no. You made Thompson's Water Seal.
Okay, I did make Thompson's Water Seal, which only works because it's a really great bad joke, and it's also kind of overpowered.
It's kind of a good spell. I think it could make it nowadays.
Like, wait, did we like restrict it to non-land?
Or I don't think so.
So it was straight up like
it was straight
boomerang
up
on a seal.
Yeah, it was seal.
Yeah, that's
kind of
good,
Cass. Even as a legendary
enchantment, that's kind of good.
I think it is like adequate at this time. I mean, the whole problem with boomerang being able to bounce lands was that there was a time when there were enough of those. Like boomerang, and then the arcane one that was a sorcery. I have nowhere or something.
Yeah.
I too nowhere. I don't know about nothing. Nowhere. No how. Something like that. And there were enough of these together in the same standard that you could make a deck out of them that simply, you know, turn two started bouncing your land every turn, so it would just keep building lands itself, and put you behind by two or three turns really early on, and then have like enough mana for counter for like bigger counter spells
bigger
to be
counter
able to
spells,
just
reloading
stuff
their hand,
anything that
to do
was
all
going on.
Crap.
I think Ebony Owl Netsuke was also there
Not
at the same
surprising.
Time. It preyed on control decks who were trying to take it slow and easy anyway. By playing just Howling Mine and overloading their hands and playing Ebony Owl Netsuke. And it was called Owling Mine. It was this lovely little thing. Yeah. But I don't think that Thompson's Water Seal could would be terrible. I think that we would need a particular kind of plane in order for it to be like relevant or fitting, I guess.
Yeah.
Like that's I'm not concerned about the power of the card anymore. I'm concerned about that it's just kind of a little weird, and it needs to make more sense somehow, and we can make it make sense by putting it in a plane that it like has legendary enchantments, and
that
makes sense.
Destroy themselves
in this plane
to do a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Like a cycle of legendary seals based off like characters on the plane. So we're going back to Kamigawa, and but it's going to be good
well,
this time.
Okay,
no GTAs.
I have, unlike Medibot, I have made multiple sets just sitting around and like hacking open Magic set editor, and I'm like, this needs like 300 cards, and I would make my spreadsheets. So set making process first is I figure out. Smashed my microphone. So, okay, step zero, smash your microphone with your forefinger while you're trying to scratch your nose from your recent illness, while you're trying to talk about making magic sets, okay?
We'll just smash whatever's around, really.
Step zero, right there. Step one is I get some, like, stupid idea for a card, and I want it to make sense. And so I can't abandon the idea, and I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if there was a card that did this? And I'd say, okay, well, let's make it more realistic, because my first idea is always just either really vague or unworkable somehow, or it does something that magic just doesn't do or isn't used to doing. And so I try to bend that into a different shape that's more like the phrasing of a real magic card. And it still ends up looking kind of weird and kind of out of place, usually. And I say to myself, okay, well, where could this live? Where could this card make sense? Kind of like with what we just did with Thompson's Water Seal. It's like, wow, that's, you know, that's a reasonable power level, but it's just kind of a little weird, so how do we make it make sense? And we set it in a plane that does something with that, and hopefully we can do that both mechanically and flavorfully, but the way I design, I go mechanics first, because the flavor follows from that, usually. I don't like doing flavor first, because that's a way to justify anything. That's a way to, like, just make stuff up and be fake and throw the color pie out the window and be like, oh, because they're rats. Rats are black, so anything that rats do, black can do. So, blah! Now it's a green card and copies of things and tokens.
Exponential rats.
Like, and they all, like, care about each other, which is really a white thing, and it's tokens, which is sort of white and green, and I'm like... Yeah, anyway.
Rats.
But it's rats! It's rats! Yeah, look back at the Return to Ravnica set review black for that. Anyway, I take this card concept, maybe even like an actual card, the way I've like typed it up in Magic Set Editor or whatever. And then I decide, okay, this is where that card lives, and let's make an entire set. So from there, with this one card, I spell out all of the different like slots for cards in a set. If it is a usual set, it's probably going to have mostly monocolored stuff, possibly one or two like multicolored things if it like makes sense for them to have that, but usually not, and a couple of artifacts and like a cycle of lands, or possibly just one or two standoff lands. I've designed a couple of blushes at multicolor lands. Those are really hard, by the way, especially given the modern design prohibition against certain kinds of things in lands anymore. You have a really hard time of things with that because any given dual land has to nowadays like not be better than a basic and not deal you damage or make you lose life, because that's scary to new players. And that's why the like underground river cycle of brushland, I guess, is a better word for that. That's why those went away, is because
the
new
lands.
Players didn't understand how valuable it was to like pay life effectively to do this. The exception being with the shock lands coming back in Return to Ravnica, of course, because that's more done for nostalgia at this point than anything else. That was just before they did their whole, like, no, dual lands shouldn't make you pay life or anything. Okay, so with an understanding of all this stuff is in your mind at the same time while you're making all these, you just, like, pull open a spreadsheet, is what I do. And I type out a list of slots, and I should probably put a link in this. There was a Mark Rosewater article. Let me see if I can get it from a Google search, all right? So I'm going to type Mark Rosewater, and then design skeleton.
That sounds good.
And...
I'd love to learn how to design a skeleton.
The first link is, crossing my fingers here, let's see, February 15, 2010. Yes! Okay, so just with that, Google search for Mark Rosewater design skeleton is not, unfortunately not, the Gawker article about Mark Rosewater's literal skeleton, but rather the design article where Mark Rosewater shows you what the like codes are for different slots in a set and kind of steps you through the basics of populating a set with simple ideas. Because all sets need to have the same kind of structure of thing. You can't deviate too far from what Magic does already. Which is why we always see the black 5 or 6 mana sorcery that says destroy target creature, and then it also does something else.
Yeah.
Usually at common, sometimes at uncommon. We also always see the 2 or 3 mana instant black removal spell that says destroy target creature with some restriction on it. And that one started to move from common to uncommon. Same thing with, say, white gets an instant that destroys a creature or exiles a creature, but only during combat. And the during combat thing can be done in any number of ways. So destroy target attacking creature, target blocking creature, target blocked creature, that kind of thing. Because white is supposed to be like the master of combat or whatever for nonsense reasons. But all sets have these things. And they need to be mostly creatures, too. So you have a lot of creatures in there. And you fill out your creature curve. And you figure... You don't have, like, hard set ideas for what these things are. But rather, you know what role they have to fill. So you need... You don't do, like, full-on cards at that point. Just ideas. So, like, common white one would be... small creature, and you just put, like, small creature in the description of the thing, and you figure out what that has to be later. Maybe it's just a 2-mana 2-2, maybe it is a 2-mana 2-1 with flying, maybe it's a 2-mana 1-3 with flying, maybe it's, if its role is just small creature, it should probably be as simple as possible. So it might even be, like, the 1-mana 2-1, or the 1-mana 1-1 with a set keyword. Mm. You know, that kind of thing. But you don't go that far even into the idea of all the design at that point, because you just have the skeleton, you know how many cards the set has to have, and that's where, you know, at this step, I put my own card, the one that we started with, right? I put that into the skeleton wherever I think it belongs. So, for Thompson's Water Seal, I would say, okay, it's a legendary blue enchantment, so it should go at rare, and I want a cycle of rare enchantments, so that would be rare blue one, say, and I would probably also at that step go to rare white one and rare green one and so on around and flesh out that cycle to get another cohesive sense of what the set is doing. And I'm kind of guilty of this, too. I design all the rares first. Because I want the rares
so those are
gonna to
be more complex and interesting and iconic.
Yeah, I want to get the most complex stuff out of the way first, and then see what I can do to, like, limit myself to get to, like, simpler and simpler things. And also, I'm really in love with vertical cycles. I love making the, like, top end of a vertical cycle... and just making it simpler all the way down until it's almost like emergent to see a common pop out of that at the end of the day. So let's do another little exercise here. If you don't mind, a little design exercise. You, Medibot, pick a rare or mythic rare card that is not a planeswalker, and I will see if I can make a vertical cycle out of it.
The first card that came into my head that fulfilled those conditions is Gristlebrand.
Whew, okay. I think you've given me an easy job of things here, actually.
Well, I love the Grizzer.
Okay, so we start out with Gristlebrand. Right, so he's huge, he's a 4 and black, 8 mana dude,
yeah.
And he's also a 7-7, right, and he has flying and lifelink, and he has that just stupid ability, you know, pay 7 life, draw 7 cards.
Power.
Okay. He's a mythic rare? He had better be. He can't be.
He's the Grizzer. Yeah, he's mythic.
God, okay. Ordinarily, when I'm doing, like, linear cycles, I also like to go through the, like, super linear, so we have, like, a rare and a mythic rare at this, but I think that would be excessive for Gristlebrand. So we're gonna go right to uncommon, and then to common. So, alright. There's a lot going on this guy. I think the most compelling, interesting feature is the kind of, linearity to it, where it's like the amount of life you get from the lifelink is exactly what you pay in the activation cost.
Right, and that's, like, made pretty obvious, so it's like, you know, connect with me and, you know, choose your reward, sort of.
Right. And it also saves mental space.
Yeah.
Right? So you don't have to remember, oh, right, you know, I'm hitting for 6, but I can pay 7 life or whatever. And so just that tiny little bit of link-up is a way to save mental space, and I think that that's also going to be important for our uncommon. Okay. Again, I could just make an uncommon, like, smaller flying lifelinker that has some, like, ability. But I think we should take this in a slightly different direction. So let's have, like, an uncommon sorcery called Touch of Grizzlebrand.
Okay. Right?
And the Touch of Grizzlebrand is going to be some, like, lesser version of what he's doing. So, I mean, it could just be like a spinning darkness kind of thing, because it, like, deal damage, gain life, because that's kind of what's what he's doing.
Yeah.
But crucially, no, it's that choice of rewards.
Right, you choose to either gain life or cards.
Yeah.
You know, as your reward for dealing damage.
Okay, how about this? We'll say it'll be an instant instead of a sorcery, right? Because it suddenly needs to be an instant. That's another. This is another little thing about designing sorceries and instants. You should make it a sorcery, unless it needs to be an instant.
Right.
So, for example, every counterspell should be a sorcery, except in order to baseline function, they need to be instants. That's why I'm really hard on them any time that I see an instant and I'm like, that should be a sorcery. That could have been a sorcery. You know, that kind of thing. But, and that's a... Because, you know, clearly they're a little loose about this rule, but I'll explain in a second why I suddenly decided that we needed an instant instead. Okay, so this is going to be a modal spell. Okay, it says choose one. Touch of Grizzlebrand with the tilde deals 3 damage to target creature, and you gain 2 life, or gain 3 life, or that's another important thing. Deals 3 damage to target creature you don't control. Because there's going to be a you do control.
Yeah.
Deals 3 damage to target creature you don't control. You gain 3 life, or deals 3 damage to... that's kind of hard to balance. Because I was going to say 3 damage to a creature you control and draw 3 cards. But that's clearly... like, bustedly powerful, no matter how
I point that
spell
at some, like, idiot token or whatever, and it's like, great, I just turned my token into 3 cards, I feel
pretty
smart.
How about this, instead of spreading the 3 all over the place, we just say, or sacrifice a creature and draw a card? Because then it that second mode will either, like, cycle or serve as a sac outlet or both.
Right.
So that's, like,
but then how
that's kind of reining in
this?
The...
I mean, like, tag a creature for 3, gain 3 seems like a 3 mana spell at instant speed. You know, just as a wild guess, black 1.
Yeah, I was thinking black 1 for this as well, and I think it should be heavier black to like also link into Grizzlebrand.
Right. Right. Grizzlebrand requires a commitment, and so does his magic spell. But then it's like, I'm paying 3 mana to have a sack outlet.
That's a fine cost. And anyway, the mode is just added utility. I'm not like, right. I'm not saying that this is like a completely perfect spell or idea, but right. It is my, that's my uncommon right here. What's the common going to be?
We can work with it. The common is going to be some like idiot lackey human who's like, oh man, I love Grizzer.
Oh man, lackey of Grizzlebrand.
Lackey of Grizzlebrand. Maybe it could be an imp.
Lackey could be an imp. I think he should fly then.
Yeah, he should fly.
No, it's straight up. He'll be, fucking... The... Oh, shit. What is that thing in Ravnica? Dagger Drome Imp?
Yeah, yeah, that would be perfect.
Straight up. Lackey
flying lifelink. Was it 2-mana, 1-1 flying lifelink?
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, he's right totally working for the Grizzer.
Yeah, and so now we have a vertical cycle of Grizzlebrand.
Yeah, we can work it out in playtests.
Yeah, but that's that little exercise, and you know when you have it finished too. That's the other thing about. Like designing my sets this way that I like, is that you know where those cards belong and how many of them you should have and what role they fulfill in the set. So the last time I did a set, I had my own cycle of planeswalkers.
Yeah,
I have 5 of them, and each of them also had spells. 3 of them. Even. So I had the Planeswalker at Mythic, and then a Planeswalker-branded spell at Rare and Uncommon and Common. Mm. Because, I mean, my set doesn't really... I mean, I don't have any time at all to acquaint you with these characters. I have only this set to be able to teach you about who these characters are and what kind of magic they do and... What would make sense
what their deal
for them,
is.
You know?
What's your
Whereas
deal,
compare that to actual Magic, where we've had a metric year to... Not even a metric, like a metric decade to figure out who Jace is and what kind of magic he does, and we still don't know. Because he changes so much, and so seemingly at random, or... What are memories, really? So they can be, like, stuff you hold in your hand, but also stuff you set to the side.
But also, like, tomatoes.
Jace, the tomato gardener. Oh, man, I read a tweet earlier today that I thought was, like, a joke. Like, I honestly thought that someone had, someone was having a little fun with one of the Magic the Gathering accounts.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was so nasty.
Oh, man. I retweeted it just because it was so hilarious. Okay. The tweet itself. They say, Jace Beleriand uncovers a magical code in the new ebook, Return to Ravnica, The Secretist, Part 1, available now, and, like, a link to Amazon. I'm like, there's
the
so
secretist.
Much comedy crammed into that one tweet. I laughed my head off at this.
The Secretist is a really good, like, fake supervillain, I think. I imagine him, like... The thing is, with a name like The Secretist, I'd believe that in the Venture Brothers, and I'd also believe that in Adventure Time. Like, this can work anywhere. We can use this everywhere, Kaz. The Secretist.
We really can. Also, like, the casual mention of ebooks, that's just a little, like...
Yes, Planeswalker ebooks.
Planeswalker ebooks is there, and then, like, Jace Beleriand uncovers a magical code. Like, just that phrase of the sentence
some
itself.
Some tosser does something that no one cares about. Where's Jaya Ballard, Wizards of the Coast?
Yeah, who cares? Seriously. Reading through this sentence, it's like they're trying to advertise to people who have never heard of magic before. Mm. You know? It's like, this is how you would tell a child about magic, right? Because it has just a dude's name. And
listen,
then it's
son.
Like, oh, he's uncovering a magical code. That sounds cool because it's like a generic cool fantasy thing that's happening. But
when two wizards love each other very much.
Since it's coming from, like, the official source, only the faithful are going to see this message.
Right, it's on the official, like, Wizard Fan Club Twitter feed.
You're not going to get any, like, new people to that. And you're not going to convince us, who already know about Magic the Gathering, to read your stupid-ass ebook, especially since you've called it Part 1. Like, I'm not even going to get the whole fucking story.
No. He discovers 1/8 of the secret code in
hooray.
In this ebook. Sorry, my bad, it's an ebook.
In this ebook. Jace Beleren goes to Hogwarts, year 1. You know?
Jace Beleren wrecks a format.
Jace Beleren, a boy of merely 12. Any of that could have made sense.
And when they banned Jace the Mind Sculptor, what actually happened is that, like, the Interplanar Police basically put, like, one of those anklets that they put on you when you're under house arrest.
Oh,
but this
definitely.
One, like, suppresses certain magical abilities.
Like,
that's
the
official
to...
explanation, actually, for what happened. That's why he can, like, still do... he's like, okay, well, I can still do this other stuff, but if I try and, like, brainstorm, this'll, like, drag me back to their, like, giga prison or whatever.
Wait. So the Eldrazi are, like, really the police of the blind eternities, and they keep planeswalkers from being, like,
I think the police are someone else.
Cause
the Eldrazi are just, like... As much as I would love the Eldrazi, you know what? Yeah, they are, because I love it.
They totally are. Oh, wait. No. They aren't, because they themselves were arrested, right? So it's like that rocksmith guy and Ugin, the spirit dragon.
Ugin, the spirit dragon, is an interplanar cop and cannot be trusted.
Self-appointed interplanar police force... And maker of invisible fire.
Yeah. I guess when, like, your name includes the Spirit Dragon, maybe you get to pick a whole bunch of other titles
at
the same
time.
Well,
I think what really happens is that after you become powerful enough, you can just attach titles to yourself like that, and fucking nobody can deal with it. It's like... Yeah, stop me, fuckers. I'm the spirit dragon now.
So
it's like Sting. Jazzy,
like,
I mean,
so the whole thing was like a jailbreak movie.
Yeah, basically. Except
no wonder
with, like,
I liked it.
Tentacular horrors popping out and Emma coming playing Battleship. Alright, so
radical.
I have the space of only one set to be able to introduce you to my Planeswalker people, which is why I, like, overloaded on Planeswalker, like, theme cards. And the way that I went through, I actually had a lot of cards first in this case, and I decided that I wanted Planeswalkers later. And I made my cycle of Planeswalkers, and then I picked out slots, either slots that I hadn't filled yet, or slots that I had filled, but I thought, hey, wait a minute, that sounds like this guy's spell. That's the kind of magic he does, and I just changed its name in some cases. I'm like, oh, well, now that belongs to him, and it's the same thing. It's not, like, Invocation of Drakes. It's now Talran's Invocation. And it does the same damn thing.
It does the same thing. It basically works.
Yeah, and that's like, a little cheap way to not, like, over-design things and still get a little bit of, like, link-up between what happens. So I do all that in the spreadsheet with the skeleton and the slot numbers and all that. And once that is full or nearly full, I start typing things into Magic Set Editor so that I can kind of see cards and see, like, what I have that's just too wordy or when it gets onto the card, it just looks like a complete mess, and I say, oh, that probably needs to be redesigned. And I also, at this step, find out how much I, like, trod upon myself when I was designing. Like, designed the same thing, like, two or three different times, or by complete mischance put four Goblin Pikers into my set, and
you
I'm like,
six
well...
six cards that are the same pterodactyl cast. Pick
maybe
one!
Maybe I don't need a set that has four Goblin Pikers, three of them at common, you know, that kind of thing, so...
Yeah.
Then having them in Magic Set Editor lets me see things that I otherwise wouldn't be able to catch just from staring at a bunch of text in a spreadsheet. I can catch most of it from the text in a spreadsheet. But also Magic Set Editor has some like neat sorting features, and it kind of fleshes it out in the meantime. Occasionally I even type, like before I even have names for all the cards, I just type the code in as the name and type it all out and go.
Yeah.
And I'll often like think of the remaining ideas while I'm typing things into MSE. So by the time I get to the point where I want to put like art on the cards, the whole set is done. Mm. There's never a time when I like find some piece of illustration somewhere and I'm like, oh, that's got to be a card that does this. No. All of my set is designed and I just need like a picture to go there so I don't get bored to tears while I'm looking at the damn thing. And that's also the part that I'm worst at. Like, whenever I'm looking for card art to go on my cards just so I can show to my friends, I start to think to myself, I'm like, man, this set isn't going to ever do anything for anyone ever, and it's really just for me and my own enjoyment, and why am I working so hard to get to steal people's art and put it on my Magic card? Because it is theft! It is! That's all that I...
Pretty much overt stealing and taking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any access to valid channels of getting illustration for cards. I just, you know, go Google image search and, like, troll DeviantArt and find things
slap
that even,
there,
like,
whatever.
Vaguely fit and throw
and that's
it
how
in.
That's how
I
got the
art
for
my
game.
Yeah, and it's completely derivative and harmless... No one ever, like, sees that and shit. Mm. And it's not like I have a bank of artists or any kind of skill to be able to illustrate
myself. You're not going and selling what you're making, so, you know.
Yeah, or even, like, it's barely even leaving my room. I mean, you've seen perhaps half of my set because
There was that one with the snakes and then that other one with the snakes.
I forced you to look at it that one time. Yeah, I wanted a plane where green was the bad guy. Like, green things were scary, and going in the woods was really frightening.
Death sentence.
And people didn't do it. And I did. I conjured up that plane and had some other stuff. So there was this duality of, like, peacefulness and civilization versus the just... unruly wilderness and the scary monsters from
Heartless
the wilderness.
Monsters.
And snakes played a big part in that set for that reason, because a snake is green, and they're also kind of scary, just innately.
Yeah.
I had one called the Ace of Snakes, which I think he was just a big hasty guy.
He had some, like, tribal thing.
Well, I'm not on the computer that has that set on it.
Did we have a Wampus in this set of some stripe? I know we had
a
Jabberwock.
I had a Bandersnatch.
Bandersnatch.
I had a couple of Bandersnatches, and we decided that all Bandersnatches have very specific adjectives for their names.
Yes.
So, what did you call it? Portmanteau words? Or is there some other word for where you take, like, half of a word and half another word?
That's a portmanteau. Yeah.
Okay, sure. So, all Bandersnatches have portmanteau adjectives.
Yes.
So, there was, like, Brilziliant Bandersnatch.
Yeah.
Because he was brilliant and resilient.
Yes.
And so, I think at first he was a troll, but then you were like, nah, trolls are kind of, like, man-shaped and not scary enough.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, well, it should be a beast. All right. How about a Bandersnatch? Those are kind of scary. You're like, yeah.
And I will take like... any excuse to shoehorn Lewis Carroll into things. So I was on board basically.
So
instantly.
Yeah, so like without changing the design of the card at all, you know, or the like mechanics or the power and toughness or anything, it changed from like tough troll to brilziant Bandersnatch. And the creature type changed from troll to beast. And that was that.
We didn't make Bandersnatch its own creature type.
Oh, wait, maybe we did. I think that's ultimately a mistake. I don't think...
Nah, it should just be Beast.
It should be a Beast.
That's fine, but, like... I would be really happy if someday in an actual game of Magic I could be like, okay, I attack you with my...
So yeah, and okay, so after we get to the set, the part of the set where I have all the set design and I have all the like cards out there,
and I come up with stupid names for your cards.
I sort of start talking with friends about it and putting art on the cards so that I can show it to the friends and say, "Hey, isn't this neat? This is this like thing that I have done on my in my own spare time with Magic cards." And hey, cool, check this out, you know, that kind of thing. Which is, it's got to be, like, the lowest form of any kind of nerddom. Like, we're way beyond official nerddom at that point. There's, like, kind of knowing about Magic and playing the game of Magic the Gathering, which is sort of okay. And then talking about playing the game of Magic the Gathering, which is also perfectly okay. And then there's cooking up fake cards for sets of Magic the Gathering that no one is ever going to play, and fewer of them are even going to, like, see it, just for yourself, just to say that you designed Magic cards. It's, like, it's so far beyond anything...
What human would choose to spend their mental resources on such a task?
Yeah, this guy, this idiot, and he's done it twice.
Wow, great job.
I designed Return to Ravnica... a couple years before Shadowmoor came out, and I had a couple designs that ended up making it into Shadowmoor. Again, basically by accident, by virtue of them being like simple enough to print. My Return to Ravnica set had Berserker Bear in it, who saw the light of day as Bloodthirsty Ogre, or what was that guy named? The guy who was like. Redden 2, 2-2, First Strike, Bloodthirst 1. And it was like Ogre Warrior or whatever. And
yeah.
Bloodthirsty Ogre. Well, for me, he was called Berserker Bear, and with creature type, Berserker Bear. And
then... flavor text, Berserker Bear.
Yeah, flavor text, Berserker Bear. And that was basically that. What else did... actually see the light of day. My card Humiliate got printed as Downsize.
Mm. Oh, and also Choke Artist.
Choke Artist got printed as Typhoid Rats.
Typhoid Rats.
Yeah. Except mine was a human assassin, and he's called fucking Choke Artist.
Yeah.
Ah! So
you
much
know
better.
It would have, like, one of the best pieces of art in the set. Or just, like, a really surprised-looking guy, and he's like, whoops!
There would be a surprised-looking guy, and there would be this so, like, casual, almost pirouetting guy behind him just snapping his neck or something.
Yeah.
Like, ah! This is how we do! Oh, man. That's what I picture in my head. Okay, so when we get to
usually my contribution to the design process is thinking of, like, wacky names for stuff, because I like things with wacky names.
Well, no, you're selling yourself a little short, because as I was saying, the next step is to actually play the game of Magic with your fake cards, which you and I did that once, remember?
We did the snakes.
We made some sealed deck pools from booster packs.
Yeah.
And built the pools and smashed them against each other. And that's when I discovered that my tireless mechanic needs a little revision and needs to be attached to creatures who aren't so individually just fucking powerful.
Yeah. it was
a little more powerful than I expected. So it doesn't belong on 3/5s, but it might belong on 3/3s or 3/2s. that kind of change. And you know, that's something that I would have to go in. It's something that you don't really realize until you play with the cards,
right?
And you say, "Oh, well, that's neat," and then, "Oh, that's neat," and then when you actually get into the thick of things, you're like,
"Oh,
oh man, this is
my
depressing."
Army kind of rules.
Yeah, and you know, you're doing all right. You have your three creatures out, and your opponent has like similar amounts of creatures. And then you play the Tireless 3/5, and suddenly my whole board is invalidated and that kind of thing. So Crossfire was one of my cards, and that was like really good. That was like premium removal in one of the things. And then I had that Turin Redcap, who was just kind of good and kind of pushed you towards mono red.
Yeah.
What else?
I don't remember too much, to be honest, other than snakes.
I remember a lot of that. Well, then again, I also like spent hours and designed every card.
You built it, Kaz. I played it twice and decided that something was a Bandersnatch.
Well, you also decided that we should stop proxying like cards and shuffling physical things together, and that you were going to code something for me that would like turn my magic set editor thing into a cockatrice markup version of the same thing.
Exports things in like an insane, inconsistent format.
Yes, it does. And cockatrice reads things in XML, which is not friendly to begin with, unless you're doing it by hand, and then it's like super friendly.
Yeah.
But you don't want to do it by hand for 300 things. Although by now, for the like years that have passed, I could have totally done that. Especially thanks to like regex
like,
codes
a
in
better, you know, come up with the actual regex for you to use rather than
yeah.
Because like, essentially the program I was writing was mostly a wrapper for regex, and then it had like,
yeah, and well, I
could write a file.
I was doing the same thing, but in Notepad++,
yeah,
and with a find replace. And throwing those regex codes into the find replace and doing it that way. And I almost did it. You know, I almost sat down and was like, okay, tonight we're going to Notepad++. And for like 7 straight hours, I would just like, and then finally get it right and
but
do it that way.
I rarely finish things.
You know what the other kind of weird part about Magic Set Editor is?
What's the
with
other
its
weird
export?
Part?
Is that there is missing information. Like, with all of the bloated information that it puts in there, it doesn't put in all of the things that you need. In particular, Planeswalker loyalty costs.
Mm.
So I had just, like, three, you know, I would look through the thing, and it, like, said the three abilities, and, you know, you hit me back after, like, looking at one of my files. He's like, you're like, wait, Kaz, what's the loyalty cost for this? And I'm like, the hell are you talking about? And it was just like three sentences of the three abilities with no like colon, no cost, nothing. And I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
With all of this extra shit it puts in there, it doesn't put in like the necessary
in, like, the
cost for
name,
things. Like,
but
ah.
Not
so,
the
yeah. Illustrator credit.
I mean, like, you know, give credit where credit's due on the Illustrator, but, like, also test your cards.
Collector's number 35 out of 301.
35 and a half out of 301.
35B.
B.
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 God, flip cards were the stupidest thing.
Man, screw magic.
Yeah.
Idiot game for fuckers.
Man,
too many
I'm thinking back
no
on
human
my
can
set.
Learn to play this game.
There is so many things in my set that I actually like. That's the frustrating part of all of it is that as stupid as it was and as pointless as this activity is, it's still fun and I have characters in there and I can talk with like at least one other human being about them.
I remember your Blue Walker who was a pirate.
He was an awesome pirate, and you helped me a lot with that guy because
yeah,
you reminded
know what to
me
to make his ultimate. I'm like, what does a pirate love to do?
And,
he loves
and I'm like,
stealing.
Oh, wait, stealing? I'll just make his ultimate blatant thievery. Boom and
boom.
Like, that I had a his first ultimate was really problematic and. Like,
it was something just, like, doofy feeling, I think. Was it some bounce effect?
Yeah, I think it was trying to be an emblem, but wasn't quite. Or, like, tapped down your opponent's board forever. I was like, nah, that's... But then you're like, no, Kaz, he's a pirate. Make him more piratical. I'm like, yeah, pirates.
Yeah, leave
and then it all clicked, and then it was all perfect. Because blue has, like, a sea theme, and that's it. Like, that blue things ran away from the wilderness by going out to sea. That kind of thing.
It's a pretty good plan as far as it goes. So what have we learned? What was the question again?
Well, the question was, what do you do when you design sets? What's your set design
process?
Well,
you do all of that
process?
Stuff.
Yeah, that's a really complete look at my own thoughts about designing a set and how I design cards and...
Whereas when I think of codes, I do it the complete opposite way. I think of some, like, goofy name for a code, and then I think, okay, what would a code with that name be?
That's also a perfectly fine way to design. It'll just leave you wanting a little bit when you get to the set level of things.
Right,
and you
like,
suddenly
for just,
have to...
designing one-off codes, it's fine, but you're not going to have any cohesion.
Yeah, so you know, then the task comes, and it's like, okay, now design 240 things. And so, alright, so I'll think up 240 names for things, and then, But no, it's completely unworkable if you try an entire set that way. You'll just...
But I
you'll
can
be
contribute
ruined.
One code to every set, and it'll be wacky and fun, and Johnny will love it, and they'll all know it was me. Because it'll be a 5-mana do-nothing enchantment in blue.
Now, I think we had a problem with my black planeswalker guy, or rather, I mean, I love him to death, and I don't want to change him at all, because I like him so much, which is kind of that's a drawback in itself of designing things, is you just fall in love with things, and you don't want to change them, or you feel offended, you know? It's like,
it's fine, don't touch it.
But my black planeswalker guy turned into an unblockable 3/3.
Yeah.
And that was one of his things. And because I kind of wanted to make him like an evil Gideon, you know, I liked the design of Gideon, and I wanted to kind of riff on that a little bit. And what ManyBot pointed out to me was that Gideon has a trick to him that subverts awkward rules by just preventing a lot of damage. Right, because the rules for damage to planeswalkers and damage to creatures are independent of one another and therefore stack in weird ways.
Yeah.
For example, Gideon can have, say, one loyalty counter left on him and still turn into a creature. Right? So he becomes a creature planeswalker that has one loyalty and six toughness. If he takes one damage, that would remove one loyalty counter, and he would die. So if you block this 6/6 with the, you know, 1/1, the 6/6 dies, and that's weird.
Yeah.
So they said, okay, well, let's put in this other thing into his Gideon's Transformo ability that just prevents damage. So that never comes up. So he's just this, like, beefy, invincible guy. Runs through, and he's a 6/6, you know, he has 6 toughness just for simplicity's sake at that point. Because making him a 6/1 would make him kind of weird, and also suddenly die to a lot of, like, toughness reduction things.
Serrated arrows.
Yeah, it's like, mighty warrior can't get past, like, one little arrow. Which, I mean, maybe would also make sense itself. So Gideon is, Gideon has a workaround, basically, for that awkward scenario that my guy doesn't. And I thought that just being unblockable was enough of a workaround. He would be a creature only for, like, half of a turn, and then he would turn back, and he would, you know, go back to the shadows, because he's a sneaky guy, kind of thing. And Since he's unblockable, he skips the step in combat where, you know, the creatures are dealing damage to him. And since you can only use that as a sorcery, you can only use it to attack. So that's... I felt that was enough of a similar workaround, just a very indirect kind of workaround for it. And Medibot didn't.
I didn't like it.
And we're still... Like, the jury's still out on that, basically.
Like, at that point...
There's no way at all that with the text of the ability I could also work in a, like, damage prevention thing.
Yeah.
It's just impossible. There's not space on the card.
You could give him hexproof.
Not black.
It's true, it's not black. Even though that is pretty roguish. And he was sort of a roguish character.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be... That'd be fitting in that sense.
Awkward interactions! Old rules that allowed me to turn Experiment Crouch into a Planeswalker!
And ascend the Pantheon! Yeah, that was back when they were, like, Planeswalker abilities and not loyalty abilities.
Yeah.
So the rad part about Garage was that he just could immediately use all of them at instant speed forever because he didn't have those same restrictions.
Garage reaches out, touches Jace, begins to glow, gains all knowledge of the multiverse, and ascends into the Pantheon, taking, you know, I guess whoever cast him with him. That should be I considered it a special win condition. If you can turn one of your creatures into a planeswalker, then you win.
I'll show you activating a planeswalker spark. This is the real magic.
It's like my character just beat my creature just beat NetHack, okay? That means I win. Ah, magic cards. Magic is
You know what else? Since my what if he turns into a 3-1 instead of a 3-3?
Then he, like, dies to, like,
then he
static caster.
Then he dies to any damage anyway.
Yeah.
So you don't care about, like, the loyalty counter double death.
Yeah.
Or whatever. It's My god, that's it. I just need to make him a 3-1.
I guess. Like, then we get some curious interactions with Anthem effects, sort of subverting your design goal.
He's black.
Bad Moon?
Well, he becomes a human rogue, I think.
Yeah.
So you'd sooner get me with, like, human tribal junk that Innistrad has.
Bad Moon.
I don't care about that shit. Again, you could also, like, deal unpreventable damage.
Right, I just, like, target opponent loses 3 life. But then, like, again, you know, that you get into the subtle ways in which you can enter, like, once it's a creature, you can change those numbers in fabulous and curious ways.
Right,
by
I don't,
just making it
there,
life
there's
loss.
No, what I should say here is, there's no way to ever permanently remove the potential for that scenario.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
If you turn a planeswalker into a creature and it keeps both types, you're going to have the potential for that scenario. What Gideon does and what my guy, who also tries to do, you know, the creature game, should also do is put up, like, one simple stop that gets in the way of that situation happening and not worry about it so much after that. And I'm able to do this with such a simple way as giving him only one toughness when he becomes a creature. I'm so happy about that.
Okay.
Shit. Where is it? I'm going to find this guy because we've talked about him enough that the Skulls Castilians should really hear his full text, I think.
Okay. We can end on that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have him in a Google Doc somewhere. Like, yeah, he's in Sully. I'm pretty sure this is up to date. Yep, there's Sully. Black. Bottom. Yeah, SUL-B51. Yep. Okay, so Mythic Black 3, the Planeswalker. Wow, was he really 5 mana? Huh, I thought I had made him cheap. Like, that was his whole point, was that he was the cheap guy. There's two. Huh, maybe I decided that later, that I was just totally fine with him going from 5 mana to 3. Whatever, I'm gonna read him as he sits here. I'm pretty sure that he should really be 3 mana. But, whatever. Okay, so currently he's 3 black-black for a 3 loyalty planeswalker named Harkin Dimtet.
Yeah.
He has plus 1. Look at the top 5 cards of target player's library and exile 1 face down. That player shuffles his or her library. Minus 2. Look at target player's hand. You choose a card from it. That player discards that card.
Nasty.
And 0. Until end of turn, Harkin Dimtet becomes a 3-1 human rogue creature that is still a planeswalker. He is unblockable this turn. And that's it. That's the guy.
Yeah, seems okay.
I'm reasonably certain that I had, like, changed him up to no longer have, what's it called, coercion in there, and somehow be okay at 3 mana? Maybe I didn't. Maybe I'm making that up. And you also have this thing where it's, like, he doesn't really have an ultimate, but his effective ultimate cannot happen on the first turn, even though you can technically activate it on the first turn, because... You know, if you cast him and then make him into a creature, he's summoning
attack.
Sick. Ah, I can't attack.
Don't
him.
You
oh,
feel
so
like
it's
a
like,
doofus?
It's neat. I like that. I like that that kind of heuristic ultimateness without having just a big minus ability.
So that's like some kind of planeswalker guy, I guess.
You really don't like this guy at all, do you?
Something about him just rubs me the wrong way.
You don't like Mini Jester's Cap?
It's alright. Well, when you put it that way, I do like it a little better. What if it were Mini Jester's Sombrero?
I'm not gonna make a planeswalker that, like, looks at your sideboard. And puts it, like, into exile. Ah!
Zones!
Maybe I am. Maybe I'm gonna design the set that has a planeswalker that has Jester, Mini Jester Sombrero as his small plus.
Yeah. Mess
honestly,
with your zones!
Yeah, honestly, the only real issue with Harkin is how he doesn't really have any, like, why would you want to build him up? Like, just to keep,
Keep him from getting, like, one-shotted? Or...
Well, no, just to keep coercioning people, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like,
keep
if I can
engine?
Coercion you 5 times in a game, I'm probably doing okay.
Honestly, if you can coercion someone twice, you're probably doing really well. Yeah, and, yeah...
Laser surgerying apart my opponent's hand, being like, nope, you're gone. Also you. Nasty. Look at all the nasty codes you can pick out of those skulls.
Man, skulls!